It's utterly useless to teach courses in morality that, you know, give rules and principles for ethical conduct or whatever, and which take no account of this relationship with God. It is only in relationship to God that one can achieve authenticity. If you exclude this relationship with God, then you have no hope of doing it. And either you will fall into hypocrisy, in other words, you will fake it, you will pretend that you're doing it and don't do it, or else you will become discouraged. Okay, so I'll stop there, and maybe we can have some discussions and questions for a few minutes. And then, okay.
The most recent question is how do you rationalize that, the necessity of having a relationship with God? I can feel it, so I feel like I'm gifted because it feels true, it feels right. So I'm just presenting.
Well, ultimately it's only through the manifestation. I mean, we use our rational minds to observe reality, to convince ourselves, to find the truth of the manifestation, who is an empirical part of reality. I mean, Mahala lived in history. I mean, this is the whole point of progressive revelation, the fact, you see, it's not the existentialist view of religion that we're talking about here. It's
but,
just not.
But let's say the world is coming from that. And that what you're presenting is, forgive me, presented as an ideology or perceived as an ideology.
Well,
I mean, one has to get.
Well, let's separate. Let's separate the reality from the articulation of the reality. Let's don't mix up the question of, first, for us, we need to understand what the reality is. How we articulate the reality to others, which avoids their misperceptions, is a pedagogical question. This is a question where methods of teaching is legitimate, okay? Methods of teaching is methods of pedagogy. It is learning how to articulate or talk about the reality of religion in a way which avoids this perception. So first we have to understand what it is, okay? That it is not ideology. And we have to understand what it, not only what it is not, but what it is. Then we have to use creative means of finding a discourse that avoids this misperception. But I mean, in some instances you can't, because we know there are all sorts of people who are so turned off about religion that they're going to misperceive it no matter what you say. I mean, if they've been done over by the Catholic Church, they may have such a thing about authority that they, you know, you talk to them about any, is there a community, is there, you know, you're obedient to the local assembly. I mean, that's enough. I mean, as soon as, that's true. I mean, we are obedient to the local assembly. I mean, so once certain people learn that, I mean, it's just too much, okay? I mean, that's it. Well, you can't do anything about that. I mean, that's part of the conditionality of access to this power. And we can talk more about this whole process. But I mean, why God has done this and why this process is going on. But I mean, you see, that's the point. In teaching the faith, it's not up to us to persuade the other person. Teaching the faith is not persuading the person to convert to an ideology. Teaching the faith is presenting him with the truest possible picture of what the faith is. That when we do that, we've done our job. Now, we do our best we can pedagogically as teachers of the faith, as pedagogues, we do the best we can to remove self-generated impediments from this process. But there are limits to what we can do in doing that. I mean, if a person, you know, has a certain set, you know, about authority or about morality or whatever, you know, then there'd be nothing in the short run you can do about it, you know. That's just the way it is. But Abdu'l-Bahá, if you look, he tells us how to do it, all right? You know, there's these, when Abdu'l-Bahá talks about, you know, each each soul teaching another soul about the faith every year. He goes through, you know, he divides it up into four periods of 3 months, you know this. And he says, the first 3 months, you look around in your environment and you observe carefully and you find the person who appears to be most receptive. That's the first 3 months. The next 3 months, you spend on showering kindness and service on this person. So you establish a relationship, a sincere friendship. I mean, of course, if you're doing this just to teach him the faith, so to speak, then it's a self-contradiction. I mean, that's just hypocrisy, right? But so this means that you have the capacity to shower love and kindness on somebody, right? It means you've already taught yourself. You've already developed spiritually the point where you have the capacity to serve other people. Where you have the capacity to get your little ego out of the way to the extent that you can actually do kindness to somebody, all right? And with Baha'u'llah's help, we can, all right? And then the third quarter, Abdu'l-Bahá says, we listen to the person. We let him empty himself. So the first act of teaching the faith is to show love and kindness. The second is to listen. Why is this? Because life is a dialogue between us and God, and every history is a history of the dialogue between God and the given person or the given culture. So when you listen to somebody, you are allowing God to tell you how to teach him the faith. That's what you're doing. You're saying, okay, God, this is one of your children. He is telling me his history of dialogue with you. And so you're allowing God to, by listening to this history, you're not only giving value to the person, saying his history is a sacred history, it is an important history, but you're also learning how to teach this person the faith. And then, Abdu'l-Bahá says, in the last 3 months, then you teach him the faith actively, and he will accept it if you've gone through these other processes. So, that's the way Abdu'l-Bahá says to overcome these kinds of resistance in individual teaching.
Where is that from, this course? The
four steps I've only had verbally. I was told this by several hands of the cause when I was on pilgrimage. I'm sure it's written down somewhere because it's the same version every time I hear it. But I honestly don't know where. I do know who knows, though, is, what's his name, who is an international counselor who lives out in Vancouver. No, he's not a counselor now. Yazdi, Mr. Yazdi, he mentioned this one. He knows this, so he probably knows the origin of it. Okay. So, is this useful, not useful? What feedback?
To me, it's very exciting because what it is very purifying. And it takes things back to a really fundamental basis.
Russia does that to you.
Yes. And I'm just thinking, as you were talking about it, that in actual fact, when the Guardian says in one of his writings that we must act, we must believe that everyone needs to accept the faith, this puts a really, sound context, puts it in context and
sure.
Purpose.
Because everyone needs to establish this authentic relationship with God. So when you're teaching the faith, all you're doing is making friends for God, so to speak. You're helping the person establish this authentic relationship, which he needs, which is the most fundamental need that he has, right?
But if he messes up, not very nice.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Phil?
Yeah. It's
all good news for you. When you talk about an ideology of any philosophy, which holds that certain ideas are superior to human beings, how does one explain the martyrdom? All martyrs?
Well, it depends on which martyrs you're talking about. If you're talking about Baha'i martyrs, these are people who have established an authentic relationship with God and who refuse to compromise this relationship by committing a morally unacceptable act that people are trying to force them to commit, like denying their faith or something else.
So it's not to uphold an ideology?
Well, in the minds of some of them it may be, but it is primarily to uphold their authentic relationship with God, right? I mean, if it was just to uphold an ideology, then why could they not, for example, do all the things that other ideologues have done, for example, dissimulate their faith in order to come back another day and argue more forcefully, or say, okay, if I want to preserve this ideology, then the best way to do it is to preserve my life so that I can go on agitating for this ideology, all right? So, but I mean, there are certainly martyrs to ideology. But you see, in martyrdom, it's not me that's killing myself, it's somebody else who's killing me, all right? So he's sacrificing me for the preservation of his ideology, all right? He's the ideologue, I'm not the ideologue. Why do I accept to die? It's because this is the only way I can maintain this authentic relationship. Otherwise, I will have to deny the very essence of my being. I will have to say, no, I do not recognize Baha'u'llah. I renounce this authentic relationship. All right? Which I have come to understand is the very purpose of my existence. For what else? Since this is the highest thing, for what else would I sacrifice it?
Okay, I guess I'm having trouble with the whole idea of ideology. And what I'm thinking is that this authentic relationship, by authentic you mean real, right? So am I...
Well, yeah, I mean real, and I mean real in terms as defined by Baha'u'llah. This means... essentially true love, when Abdu'l-Baha talks about the four kinds of love. So I use authenticity instead of love simply because love is so overused and so on, has so many contexts, and because we think of love in so many different ways. But you could just say true love, yeah, you can.
So true love, or authentic, can also be an ideology.
No, not love is not an idea.
Okay,
an ideology is a philosophy. A philosophy is a certain set of ideas,
or
beliefs. Love is not a belief, love is a force.
Yeah, when you read that helped, because I kept thinking is love an ideology, and then you read Abdu'l-Baha.
No, an ideology is a belief. It is a set of subjective ideas. It's a set of ideas. Love isn't an idea. Love is a force. It's an objective existing force, like gravity.
A way of grasping reality. So,
but we have to distinguish in all cases. I mean, this just goes back to philosophy 101, right? I mean, you know better than that, the difference between the thing and the idea of the thing and so on, okay? I mean, and you have ideas of ideas and ideas. This is abstraction. Certainly, right? I mean, so love is not an idea, right? Love is not a subjective idea. Love is an objectively existing force, like gravity, which is experienced subjectively just as ideas are experienced subjectively. So love is a different thing from our ideas about love, just like gravity is different from our ideas about gravity. I mean, Newton's law of gravity is not gravity. Newton's law of gravity is a human articulation of the objectively existing law of gravity. If Newton had never existed, gravity would still exist in the same way, right? So love exists and it is what it is, regardless of whether we have the right idea or the wrong idea about it. So love doesn't depend on our ideas about love. Now, our access to the power of love may be dependent on our ideas, and I'm saying the most pernicious idea is the idea that some set of ideas is more important than love itself. Okay? So I sum this up by saying all ideologies are false, because an ideology holds, this doesn't say that all ideas are false. An ideology is a certain kind of idea that I've just defined. It is an idea about ideas. Okay? An ideology is the idea that some set of ideas is more important than human beings. Okay? So an ideology is an idea about ideas. It's a second order idea. We have ideas about objective things, but I can have ideas about ideas, like that one idea is better than another idea. That's an idea about ideas, right? So, I'm saying that this idea, okay, that this idea that there are some sets of ideas which is superior to human being, the idea that any set of ideas is superior to human beings is a false idea. Such an idea I call an ideology. Therefore, all ideologies are false. Now notice, I haven't talked about the content, whether these ideas are good or bad. They may be very good ideas. Look, let me give you two examples. One part of Baha'i belief is that God exists and that we should believe in God, right? Right? So we will agree it is a good thing for people to believe in God. Sincerely in God. I'm not playing games with this, all right? Right? Certainly we agree with this. Right? That's a good idea. So any Baha'i would be willing to assent to the proposition, it would be a good thing for everybody on earth to believe in God. Now, let's make this into an ideology. Let's say that the idea that people should believe in God is more important than human beings. Then I'll give you the easiest way to accomplish this ideology. Kill everybody who doesn't believe in God. Right? The people who left will be the believers in God. Okay? I will have achieved my goal. Everybody on earth believes in God. I mean, even after I kill them down to the last 10 people, then everybody on earth will believe. I will have accomplished that goal. And that's, in fact, the quickest way to do it. Right? That's the quickest way to do it. On the other hand, what does religion say? Why is this not an idea? Because what religion says is that the important thing is to love other people. And if you love other people, they will believe in God because they will experience true love, and the experience of true love is that which makes people most inclined to believe that there is a source of true love, and therefore to believe in God. So believing in God has much more to do with the establishment of authentic relationships than it does belief in an abstract idea. Okay, so that's an example of where we have a perfectly good idea, a certain idea, which we agree is very good, but by adding the meta-belief that this, the propagation of this idea is superior to any human being, then we come to the conclusion that it is permissible to sacrifice human beings to propagate this idea. And we can kill all the human beings who are unbelievers, which is exactly what the Muslim fanatics are doing, what the born-again Christians are doing, and so on and so on. So this is not an abstract debate. We're going, this is exactly what people do.
What if we considered ideology, and this is kind of semantic, a study of ideas? Isn't logos a study or something?
Well, that's something else.
It's like this is a really... I'm wondering, and so I need to get to a dictionary at lunchtime. understand the word ideology, to ensure that...
Well, this is my definition. You won't necessarily find that idea. But you see, this is ideology gives a certain value to the ideas. You can't, it's not, a study can be objective. So an ideology is not studying ideas. An ideology comes from the marriage of ideas with a certain value system. And it is the value system that says these ideas are more valuable than human beings. So unless you make value judgments, you never get an ideology. An ideology is not an abstract consideration of ideas, however ideal or abstract.
It's a process then.
Well, it's a process of valuing ideas. It's a judgment. It becomes a process, but it is... It can be a static thing as well. It can be simply, it is a value judgment about ideas, namely that they're superior to human beings. What could be simpler? So an ideology is a certain kind of value judgment. It's a value judgment which gives greater value to certain ideas than it does to human beings. What could be simpler than that? Oh? Okay. Peace. Okay.
Lunch, and we're going to have session two of Dr. William Hatcher on the subject of moral and social development. Obviously, we found this morning very stimulating because I could hear during the lunchtime intense discussions going on about authentic relationships and other things. And so I'm sure that this afternoon will be very exciting. So please welcome Dr. Hatcher.
Okay, so this morning we saw that true religion is not a social contract, nor is it an ideology, but it is the establishment of authentic relationships, that is, a certain kind of relationship. First between each individual and God, and then based on this, between and among individuals in various community configurations and so on. So true religion is a relationship, a quality of relationship, a certain kind of relationship. And everything else is subservient to this. Ideas, beliefs, social processes, interactions of various sorts, laws, principles, all serve the goal. They are not the end in themselves, but they are the means by which we attain this goal. And the goal is the establishment of this quality of relationship between God and ourselves. Let's read where Shoghi Effendi speaks of this. This is taken from page 136 of The Law of Love Enshrined. So I'm sorry that you don't have your copies, but I will just read. This is in one of the compilations. I think it's the one talks about meditation and a spiritual attitude or something like that. What is it?
Prayer, meditation, and spiritual attitude.
Is that what it's called? I think it's in that one. In any case, Shoghi Effendi says, indeed the chief reason for the evils now rampant in society is the lack of spirituality. So, this is the first thing. Spirituality, the lack of spirituality, is the chief reason for all of the evils. The materialistic civilization of our age has so much absorbed the energy and interest of mankind that people in general do no longer feel the necessity of raising themselves above the forces and conditions of their daily material existence. There is not sufficient demand for the things that we call spiritual to differentiate them from the needs and requirements of our physical existence. The universal crisis affecting mankind is therefore essentially spiritual in its causes. The core of religious faith is that mystic feeling which unites man with God. All right, so here we see again a definition of religion, right? The core of religious faith, what is religious faith? Is it believing in a set of propositions? He says, no. The core of religious faith is that mystic feeling which unites man with God. This state of spiritual communion, so it's a kind of a relationship. It is a relationship of dialogue. This state of spiritual communion can be brought about and maintained by means of meditation and prayer. And this is the reason why Baha'u'llah has so much stressed the importance of worship. The Baha'i faith, like all other divine religions, so now we're talking about not just the Baha'i faith, but all religion, is thus fundamentally mystic in character. It's not me, it's Shoghi Effendi. Its chief goal is the development of the individual and society through the acquisition of spiritual virtues and powers. It is the soul of man which has first to be fed. And this spiritual nourishment, prayer can best provide. Okay? So there it is. I mean, nowhere do we see that the core of religious faith is believing in this or that or the other thing or whatever. It is a quality of relationship. It is that mystic feeling which unites man with God. All the divine religions are fundamentally mystic in character. The chief goal of religion is the development of the individual in society through the acquisition of spiritual virtues and powers. It is the soul of man which has first to be fed, and this spiritual nourishment, prayer can best provide. So another way of saying this notion that true religion is establishing authentic relationships is to say that the meaning of life is a dialogue. Life is an ongoing dialogue between God and ourselves and between ourselves and others based on our dialogue with God. If we don't have the dialogue between God and ourselves, then we have very little to say to other people. In other words, so again, I stress the fact that the successful dialogue with other human beings depends on and grows out of our inner dialogue with God. If we don't have this inner dialogue, we do not have inner development, and so we have nothing of significance to say to other people. And if other people say significant things to us, we won't understand them. They will not be interesting to us if we have not developed the capacity to understand them. Or if people talk about their pain, then we will become frightened and we will back away from the relationship because it will put a stress on us that we can't bear, because pain is very authentic. Pain is one of the most authentic experiences that we have. And as Khalil Gibran put it in the Prophet, that we cannot know joy unless we know pain. The deeper our pain, the deeper our joy. You can't have one without the other. You can't have one without the other. So if you're unwilling to experience pain, then you will be incapable of experiencing joy. It's just that simple. If you refuse the experience of pain, then you are, by that very choice, cutting yourself off from the experience of joy. You simply cannot experience joy. Let me digress slightly on that point, because that brings out another cultural difference between North American culture and the Russian culture that I have become involved in for the last 3 years. As I say, I have actually been involved with Russia for 5 years, although I've only lived there for the last three. Let me give you a few facts, just observations, which will then lead to a comment. The first comment is this. I have never, ever seen a Russian child misbehave in public. I have never, ever seen a Russian child scream or cry or have a tantrum in public. Never. I have seen Russian children, seven-year-old children, sit through a four-hour opera performance and enjoy it and not move from their chair. Okay? First observation. Second observation is, suffering for suffering, I think none of us would doubt that the Russian people have had a lot of suffering in their lives, right? A lot of suffering. Certainly, we can say that we've had a lot of advantages, in material advantages, certainly in North America, that the Russian people have not had. And we can certainly appreciate the fact that the Russian people have had tremendous sufferings that we have not had. Think of the siege of Leningrad, which is the city I live in. In 800 days, there were over 1 million people who died of starvation. I had several Baha'is in the Baha'i community in Leningrad actually lived through the siege of Leningrad as children. One of them calmly told me that one of the greatest moral dilemmas they had during the siege of Leningrad, when Leningrad was totally encircled by the Nazis, if you don't know the history, nothing could come in and out of Leningrad. The Nazis never took Leningrad. They never took Leningrad, but they completely cut it off and they tried to starve it to death. And they succeeded in starving 1 million people to death. So this Baha'i calmly told me that one of the greatest moral dilemmas that the inhabitants of Leningrad faced was whether or not to eat a dead member of the family when they died. In other words, if their sister died, should they eat them or not? Because if they didn't eat them, then they might very well die. They didn't kill them, so should they eat the flesh of their dead sister or brother or not? Now, undoubtedly, the Babis at Sheikh Tabarsi were faced with the same dilemma. Although it's not recorded in any book I know, quite clearly they were also being starved, and it is said in Nabil that they ate shoe leather and they ate the flesh of their dead horses when they were, you know, when they were struck down, when their horses were killed. They ate the flesh of the horses, and so on. So, again, I'm not interested in getting into the question of under what circumstances might it be morally acceptable to eat the flesh of another human being or not, or whatever. The point is that you will agree that this is a genuine moral dilemma. This is not a question of whether or not you shall take a social drink, or whether or not you should tell your kids about Santa Claus, or whether or not you should celebrate Christmas as a Baha'i, okay? This is a real moral dilemma, right? Also, it is known that Stalin, in what has been known as the Terror, killed over 30 million of his fellow countrymen in the persecution. In other words, besides the 20 million that were killed by the Nazis in the war, there were another 30 million Russians who were killed by their own leaders in all of the gulag, in all of the camps. So there is hardly I dare say that one does not even have to relativize it. There is certainly no family in the whole of Russia that has not been touched by this persecution, who has not had a brother, sister, aunt, or uncle, some close family member who has been in prison or killed or suffered from this persecution. And of course, the conditions under which this persecution happened was one in which people were denouncing each other to the KGB, husbands were spying on wives, and so on and so on. So this reached down into the very family unit. For example, in the schools in Russia, they would start out telling the children in kindergarten in grade one, they would say things like, there is a mental disease that's called believing in God. And if you know of anybody who has this disease, you should tell us about it, because you certainly love your parents, and if they're sick, you want them to be helped, and we can help them. So in this way, they would induce children to spy on their parents. So there could not even be honesty within the family unit. The parents dared not tell the truth to their children. And even then, the husband and wife couldn't discuss the truth openly among themselves, because one of them might be arrested and tortured and forced to denounce the other. So the result was that the family unit was totally destroyed in Russia. Well, this is a few observations to give you an idea of the scale of the thing. Well, I have never, ever heard a Russian say, why did this happen to me? Why did this suffering happen to happen? You know, if somebody's kid gets run over and killed by a car, the Russians will grieve. All of his friends will come and grieve with him. And they will cry and they will lament, and then they'll get on with their lives. And if somebody were to say, why did this happen to me? You would say, why not? It happens to everybody. Everybody suffers. Well, this is the human condition. We all suffer disease, accidents. This is the human condition. Why should it not happen to me? I'm nobody special. Okay? So, I've never yet, I mean, I'm not saying it won't happen, but I have never heard a Russian say, why would this happen to me? It would never occur to a Russian to say, why did this accident or this unhappiness or this affliction happen to me? It is assumed that this is the human condition, at least in this mortal world, that it is a place of afflictions, of tests, of suffering, and this is the human condition. And so we must help each other, we must grieve over each other, but the minute you ask for a special treatment, your friends will withdraw. In other words, they will give you all consolation in the world, but they will not give you special treatment, because everybody has their problems, and your lot in life is to bear your problems. We will help you, but don't ask for special treatment. So what we see in North America now is what I call victimization through minorization, you see. Everybody becomes a victim by virtue of becoming part of some minority, okay? And this allows, this victimization allows him to blame the troubles in his life, whatever they are, on somebody else. It's somebody else's fault, anybody else's fault but my fault. So now children are no longer raised by their parents, they're victimized by their parents. And wives don't live with their husbands, they're victimized by their husbands. And husbands by their wives, and so on it goes. Everybody's a victim, homosexuals by heterosexuals, whatever you want. But in order to be considered a victim in North America, you have to be part of a recognizable minority group. Otherwise, you can't be a victim, okay? In Russia, the view of life is that everybody's a victim. And therefore, nobody deserves special treatment. So you're a victim? Sure. So what? So what's new? We're all victims. So, sure, yeah, you're right. But this is unjust. This happened to me. That's right. It's unjust, man. It's really unjust. I mean, that's right. So? So it's unjust. So you have to deal with it. That's right. Unjust is real stuff. Okay? they don't expect life to be just. Well, I'm not saying that this is a perfect worldview. It leads to the kind of fatalism that we also associate with the Russian mentality. That's undoubtedly one of the reasons why they haven't had a capitalistic economy that develops the way the pragmatic North American economy does. All I'm saying is that other views of life are possible. All I'm saying is that it is not a genetic inevitability that our kids are so generally ill-behaved and that we all consider ourselves unfair victims of circumstances of life which are beyond our control and which entitle us to complain eternally about our condition rather than getting on with the process of spiritual development that we talked about this morning. So the point is then that here in North America we have come to consider suffering as abnormal. Now you see, clearly suffering is unpleasant. Nobody denies that. The Russians, I mean, you torture a Russian, it hurts him just as much if you torture a Canadian, all right? If a Russian child is killed in an automobile accident, he suffers just as much, he loves his child just as much as a Canadian parent would if his child was run over by a car. I mean, this is universal, all right? This is universal. But the attitude toward this is different, okay? It hurts just as much, but the attitude is different. Because the North American will tend to say, this is unfair, this is abnormal. But the Russian won't say that it's abnormal. He'll say, yes, it's very painful, it's bloody painful. But it's not abnormal. It's not something that you shouldn't expect that could ever happen. But there are consequences to worldviews, you see. There are consequences, positive and negative consequences. One of the negative consequences of the Russian worldview is this fatalism that I was talking about. But one of the negative consequences of the North American ultra-pragmatic worldview, which sort of holds that everything can be overcome if you just throw enough money at it, right? In other words, if you just have enough money for AIDS research, you know, then eventually, you know, this will be solved and so on and so on. And if you just have put enough money into pollution control, this will solve it without our having to change our behavior. In other words, it's never us that has to change. We can change the environment to suit ourselves. So this is the pragmatic point of view of the North American, that any problem can be overcome. Now, this led us to put a man on the moon before the Russians did, okay? In other words, this has positive consequences. This pragmatism, this we can do anything sort of thing, it has very positive consequences. But it also has negative consequences.